So with that, let's. Our first speaker is Dr. Doug Barnhart. Dr. Barnhart is from Primary Children's at Salt Lake City, where he's a professor of pediatric surgery. He has been part of this process since its inception, including the initial task force, and he's a member of the verification committee and will become co-chair.
Good morning. My task this morning is to give you a bit of an overview, particularly about the application process and the verification process, with a particular emphasis on the performance improvement patient safety program, because we recognize that that is the major change for most centers that will go through this. There will be some centers that have personnel changes as well, and perhaps service changes that they offer, but for most centers, the real crux of getting ready for this is your performance improvement. So I'll spend a significant portion of the time talking about that. I don't have any disclosures. As Keith said, I am the medical director for children's surgery at Primary Children's, and we're in the application process. So we are as yet an unverified center, but we're in the thick of it. So I've seen it on the side of writing the standards and now living them, and I'll try to share some of both the challenges and the benefits that we've already experienced. What I'll try to do this morning with you is to give you a brief overview of the verification process, just the various steps, so you can understand what the process is and think about how to approach it. Talk a little bit about the site visit and what actually occurs on that. For those of you that haven't been through an ACS site visit in the past, this may be a source of anxiety, and the primary goal in that is to put you at ease about that. I'm going to talk a significant part about the areas of improvement that the centers that either did the pilot program or that have already been visited, where they made significant changes, because I think they're common themes that all of us are dealing with. Talk about the PIPS part, and then identify some of the common challenges and clarify just a couple of areas of confusion that have come up as questions. So verification is a stepwise process, and I think it's worth thinking about each one of these steps as we view how to approach this. I'd say the very first step is a readiness assessment of your own center, and this is really something you would do yourself, or as Dr. Oldham said, in January we'll start to offer a consultative process to help you with that. That consultative process is intended really, I think, largely to help you think about how to solve problems that you've identified as potential weaknesses and honestly to help your administration understand the changes that need to happen for you to be ready. But in that, obviously, the very first part is to carefully review that the criteria that are in the book. They're clearly outlined. If you have questions about what they are, that's a good time to ask, and create a gap analysis of what you need to change. I think at that point, you really need to have a serious discussion with hospital leadership of whether they're committed to the process. And to get a formal commitment, and we'll talk about that, as a major part of that is a commitment of them to have a qualified program manager. I think centers that try to do this without a real program manager will not be successful. It's a big job, and you need to have the right person in that job. Also, if you're not in pediatric NISQIP, that's job one in getting your application going. You need to get enrolled in NISQIP because you have to have that data and be using it as part of your quality improvement at the time of your site visit. So, and that takes about a year to get the first time where you've got enough data in where you get stuff back to have a semi-annual report. So those are your first steps. After you make that assessment, your hospital's committed, the next thing is to begin what we call the pre-application with the ACS. This is where you'll actually sign a contract and understand what's involved. At that point, the ACS will assign one of the program coordinators on the staff to help you through the process and to be your primary contact. Once that pre-application is completed, they'll then open the pre-review questionnaire, or which is what we call the very long and detailed application. The major part of preparing for this, other than creating the new PIPS process, is to complete this PRQ. It really is a profile of your hospital and the way you do children's surgery that allows the site visitors to understand how you work. And this is a lengthy process that will involve multiple people in the hospital writing. In that are a couple elements that we'll talk about later, which is the safety data table and the clinician tables. All of that then culminates with the site visit, and we'll then a little bit I'll talk about exactly what goes on in the site visit. At the conclusion of the site visit, you'll hear what the findings are of the site visit team. You won't have a final decision about verification. That is done by the verification review committee. So within the month, the committee will meet, go through the report. The senior lead visitor will present the findings, and the verification committee will make a decision on the final status. And then you'll know, and we have been able to turn those decisions around fairly quickly. So just the basics of the site visit. The official goal of the site visit is to verify that the center meets all the criteria outlined in the standards. Doing the site visits, my view is it's really an opportunity for the people that do children's surgery in that hospital to show off how they do. Performance improvement is one goal. I think everybody that's in this process has made significant improvements and has a story to tell. And it's really, I think, an opportunity for people to celebrate their successes. The other hidden goal in that is if you're the anesthesia or surgical lead in your hospital, it creates an opportunity to have us help your hospital understand what you need to do to be more successful. And that'll be one of the things we specifically ask about in the interview, so that we can, if there are needs that you recognize, that we can help point out the importance of those, of meeting those needs. So again, I think it is a significant amount of work to prepare for this. You should view it as a collegial visit that's intended to help you be better. We really don't want it to feel like Joint Commission coming to visit. The duration of the visit is 1.5 days. It's very similar to what happens on a trauma site visit if you've been through it. So it begins on the afternoon of the first day. That really goes through all the way into evening with a dinner. And then the next morning, do it, and then typically wrap up by noon or one. The team composition will have a lead site visitor who's a member of the verification committee. There'll be two additional visitors. It'll always include a surgeon and an anesthesiologist. We do have nurses on the team, which are very helpful. We, at this point, don't have a big enough cadre of them that we can always have a nurse, but it'd be our goal to have all three of those components on the site visit teams. What happens on the site visit, begin with a chart review, which we'll give you a specific list of patients that need to be included in that. And really the purpose of those chart reviews are to look for compliance with the standards for things such as physician presence and participation in care, and also to try to identify opportunities for improvement and then allow you to show us how you identified those in your system and actually what you did with closed loop performance improvement. The next part of the site visit is interview with key leaders, and this is really, to understand how your system worked and again, to give your clinical leaders opportunities to talk about challenges they have, if there's specific ways they want us to help the hospital understand their needs better. We'll review the PIPS meeting, and then there's a PIPS program, then there's a dinner meeting with a large group, and really, again, the purpose of this is not to be cross-examination, but to, if there are parts in the PRQ that are unclear that we want to clarify to make sure it meets the criteria, and that's the real purpose of the dinner, that we can ask actually how you do this coverage if you have adult providers. Tell us specifically about what it's done, and the site visit leader will really kind of run that, and everybody will have a portion, and really we try to have it not be that you go through the whole PRQ, but really just clarify the areas that are unclear. The next day we do a tour of the hospital ambulatory center and finish up any other parts, and then have a presentation of the findings, which again is not the final verification status, but really identifies the strengths and weaknesses and the parts that are exemplary. The heavy lifting of this program is in the performance improvement and patient safety. Bob Sowen led the efforts on this on the task force to write this, and as we started to write this, I remember saying, these seem like great standards and my hospital doesn't meet them. Which I think then there was uniform consensus around the table that all of us had that situation when we started. So it does represent a significant change in how we do business. I think all of us believe it makes us better. So I think the benefits of this style of PIPs that we're asking people to do is, number one, it really is an expanded view of what surgical care is. I think in many places before this, what you viewed as surgical quality is what happens in the perioperative setting. So operating room, PACU, post-op care was what we viewed as surgical care. This really, like the trauma system, demands that we view surgical care of children from the moment they present to healthcare until they're rehabilitated and discharged, and all of that is our responsibility as surgeons. So it means that you have to be much more multidisciplinary than you've probably been in the past, including bringing PICU docs, newborn intensive care unit docs, and emergency medicine doctors into your surgical improvement system. This really will change how you view what you can accomplish with your surgical quality improvement system. Just a simple example out of ours is we had a kid that came in with an airway emergency, and there was some debate about the best way to get the kid to the OR. It was a night that ENT was on. A mid-level ENT resident added on as emergency, was not that familiar with our system, know how to exactly make that happen as an emergent case, got the kid up there, anesthesia wasn't ready, and the OR wasn't ready because they'd started a fracture. And a lot of finger pointing would be the classic way of dealing with that. But with this surgical PIPs thing, was pretty clear what we needed was a level one response to airway emergencies, and which, like we do with trauma, is very easy to have a set of people that are there that the emergency physician is agreeing that they'll audit it so it's not overused, and have them generate specific criteria, and with all the surgeons and anesthesiologists at the table come up with what exactly the ideal response should be. So I think in that simple example, we're going to provide better care in our place because we've got a multidisciplinary approach to it. The other thing that you'll bring into this is some specific metrics that we'll ask you to do, which is to look at time to treat critical procedures. You'll be using your NISQIP data. And then the other component that's required that I think many of us had not done before is a centralized surgical mortality review that I think in many places mortality and morbidity reviews is very siloed within divisions, and there's not necessarily a hospital awareness unless it's a serious safety event. So that's one of the requirements, I think, for many of us that's changed how we view approaching mortality and the overall responsibility of the surgical services. There are some challenging areas in this that I want to talk to you about. One, just to acknowledge that they're challenging for everybody and also to give you some insights of what the expectation is at this initial visit. The first is there's an expectation that you identify opportunities for improvement from transferring centers and give feedback. We've not yet encountered a center that was doing this well before they started this program. So we recognize that identifying the issues is a challenge, and then having a way that you communicate back to centers in a structured fashion doesn't exist in most places. We're working on that in ours. We now have a way that we know every time a kid's transferred in and immediately ask the surgeon if they identified any issues that we can feedback. We've got the interesting thing out of that is our hospital is now committed that they're going to come up with a way to identify a medical lead in every hospital that we get patients from to communicate back to. So it's, and obviously once you do that, the overflow of that is, well, boy, we ought to do that on every medical patient too. So we're still figuring that out, but I think really our goal is that at this stage that people be working on that process. Another challenge is verifying timely response of physicians to consultations. There's a 60-minute requirement. You need to figure out how you're going to do that. I think most places right now are just doing it on an event-based thing when it doesn't happen. And we also look at timely response to these OR emergencies as a way to do that. And again, just this idea of getting out of our silos and working as an integrated system, I think, is a real challenge for everyone. One thing you'll need to do specifically, there's specific safety events that you'll need to identify, and this is outlined in the manual, so I won't go into that in great detail, but again, you need to use electronic medical record and be working on a way to get better at detecting these events. A couple areas that are areas where centers have had to change that, depending on how you practice in your place, may be a challenge that you need to think about. There is this requirement that you do age-specific privileging. This is more of a challenge for places where they're part of a large adult system that may do central credentialing, even of the pediatric providers. There's some of the children's hospitals where all the privileging is done centrally. And we have a requirement that operative privileging must be age-specific and that you need to monitor the appropriate use of those privileges. We recognize that in most of these places, the practice is already limited, but privileging isn't. And the challenge I'd put before you is in privileging, what you're supposed to be doing is verifying that people are proficient and competent to do those things. And the question would be how you could actually privilege someone for something they don't do because you actually can't be sure they're competent. The expectation of this is you have a process in place and it's beginning to happen. We recognize in many places people reprivilege every 2 years. You don't have to reprivilege everybody out of cycle to meet this, but you ought to have that privileging process defined and actually have it in process and be able to demonstrate that some people have gone through it. Another area is the coverage by non-pediatric specialists. Not in pediatric general and thoracic surgery, but in some of the other specialties, you're allowed to use non-pediatric specialists to provide some coverage. If you do that, you need to have the scope of practice defined and you need to monitor it. And there needs to be a backup call system so that there is a pediatric specialist available 24/7. Just for clarification, there are two types of pediatric physicians that are not board certified that can be included in the program. The first and the most simple is the alternative pathway, which is really intended to cover those that really are like your board certified providers, but in some way are different, so they can't be board certified. The classic example of this is somebody that's internationally trained, because if you train even in England, you can't sit for American boards, so you can't be board certified in the subspecialty. We obviously recognize those people have expertise. There's also some providers that may have been the fathers or mothers of the subspecialty, so they don't have board certification because it didn't exist when they helped create their subspecialty. Again, those people that are fully devoted to pediatric practice, we want to recognize their expertise, and that this is outlined. The other group is generalists with pediatric expertise, and these are only in level two centers, which again are providers that do some peds, but not are not the equivalent of ped subspecialists. And those, and again, these are outlined. This is used in radiology and some in anesthesia. So we're going to hear from a children's surgery program manager, but I do want to just again reiterate, this is fundamental to your program success, is having somebody that's going to drive this whole process and the performance improvement in an ongoing fashion as a full-time job. There's not a requirement that it be a full-time FTE. I think for any busy children's center, if you're going to do this in a real way, it has to be. It's probably more than one person's job, at least in our experience. Just a couple things I wanted to clarify because they'd come up as questions. The first is that we do not have, there's not a requirement that level one centers have a surgical residency. This had been in discussion early. I think there were concerns raised about it, and it is not a requirement. You do need to participate in education, and again, that's outlined in the manual, but it does not have to be a surgical residency. The other thing, we've also recognized that there are some procedures that and specialties that are very volume, there's a very clear relationship between volume and quality, and we don't want to cause a proliferation of low volume centers. And this is particularly true for ECMO and congenital heart surgery, so you can be a level one center and not offer those. If you don't offer them, you have to have specific transfer agreements and ways that you can demonstrate that you provide that care in a coordinated fashion, even if you don't have them. But you do not need to have congenital heart surgery or ECMO to be a level one center. And finally, I just wanted to reiterate that we want this to be a process by which we help each other get better. And the college is here to support you, not only in how you actually get better, but also how you do the application. They're very responsive if you reach out by email with questions or call in. It's easy to find them. If you just Google children's surgery verification, it's the top hit, so you don't need to remember the website. It's got the email contents. And then if you have the standards documents, it does have all the committee members on that. I think we're happy to talk with you about the spirit of it. If you want specific answers about the process or the requirements, I'd encourage you to have those conversations with the college staff, because they're the most up to date, and they'll give you the most consistent answer if it's coming from the college staff. If you have questions about how have other people approached this or solved this problem, that's something I think the committee would be happy to help you with. So thank you, and I'll look forward to taking your questions at the end.
Thank you, Doug.